You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Madam Secretary, Your Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of Carnegie Europe and the European Council on Foreign Relations, welcome to this public conversation with Dr. Madeleine Albright and Mr. Jérôme Vandenberg. It's a real pleasure to have you here this afternoon. Dr. Albright and Mr. Vandenberg were earlier at NATO headquarters to deliver as respectively chair and vice chair of the group of experts on NATO's new strategic concept to deliver their recommendations to the North Atlantic Council and the NATO Secretary General. My name is Fabrice Potier. I am the director of Carnegie Europe, the Pan-European Foreign Policy Forum of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And because now coalition politics is the new game, especially in the UK, I have the pleasure to co-host today's conversation with my colleague and my friend, Daniel Korsky, Senior Policy Fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. First, I would like to say some few words of thanks, starting with NATO, especially Jamie Shea, who is at the back. He had promised to be at the back, so Jamie, who made this today's presentation possible. Thank you. I also wanted to thank Ambassador Ivo Dolder and the U.S. mission to NATO, who have provided the generous support to Carnegie Europe and ECFR's joint project. And today, in fact, is the culmination of a journey for the group of experts, which brought him through cities, many issues, volcanic ashes. But it's also the culmination of a journey for both Carnegie Europe and the European Council on Foreign Relations. So before I turn to our speakers, I just would like to say a few words about that project. In the summer of 2009, Carnegie Europe and ECFR joined forces to launch a series of regional roundtables called Next Generation NATO. The principle was, because the strategic concept is about the future, we wanted to engage with the upcoming generation of policymakers and analysts, but not only in NATO's land, but also at the margins of NATO. So we took the discussion to Russia, to Eastern Europe, and to the greater Middle East. We started in Dubai, then went to Moscow, then finally in Sofia. And in each region, we asked a very simple but important question about how do you define your security, and where do you view NATO fitting in that world of yours? And we obviously got some very interesting, thought-provoking answers. An analyst from Ukraine explained that NATO had lost the narrative in Ukraine. A participant in Russia explained that reciprocity in partnership, especially in Afghanistan, is key to build trust. And in Dubai, a colleague from Kuwait reminded us that Iran's nuclear ambiguity represents a core concern and also a chance for cooperation with NATO. In all three regions, the common thread was suspicions and misperceptions mixed with hope and desire to work together. So this is where this journey meets yours, Dr. Albright and Mr. Jérôme Vandenberg, to talk about NATO's next generation. And I think the part of the report that best encapsulates this question are, in fact, the very first two words, NATO 2020. 20 years after the end of the Cold War, almost 9 years since 9/11 and the intervention in Afghanistan, this is clearly crunch time for NATO. So that flows from the point of the report, which tackles the very important question of what should NATO's purpose be for the future? What is the compelling narrative that NATO can build to remain the effective and important politically and military alliance for the 21st century, especially in a very complex, fragmented world where security and threats are not as obvious as they were 20 years ago? So on the report, I just would like to say a few words of congratulation. I think to use Jean Cocteau, a French writer, who said that the true elegance was in simplicity. And I think the true elegance of this report is to lay a very clear, crisp, and simple language to tackle very complex issues. So let me now introduce our speakers today, starting with Dr. Albright, who is the chair of the Albright Stone Ridge Group, a global strategy firm, and chair and principal of Albright Capital Management. In 1997, Dr. Albright was named the 64th and first female Secretary of State of the United States, where you oversaw NATO's first military intervention and also a dramatic expansion to the east. Before being in Foggy Bottom, you were in New York as the U.S. permanent representative to the United Nations. Mr. Jérôme Vandenberg was president and chief executive officer of Royal Dutch Shell until June 2009, where you started in 1971. So just to explain a bit on the way we're going to proceed today, following Dr. Albright's opening remarks, we will open a conversation with Daniel and both Dr. Albright and Mr. Vandenberg, and we have a very solid list of pointed questions for you. So we will challenge you on the report. And then we will open up the floor to a Q&A, which we hope will be lively and engaging. I know that there are participants from College of Europe, I don't know where you are, College of Europe, you are maybe, around, and Kent University. So we are going to play Kent University against College of Europe. But before that, please join me in welcoming Dr. Albright. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Fabrice, and thank you to Carnegie as well as the European Council on Foreign Relations for sponsoring this event. And guests and friends, good afternoon. I'm very happy to be here. I hope by now that most of you have had a chance to at least see the report released by the group of experts. And based on that assumption, I will keep my own remarks brief so that we really can have time for a discussion. Now, to begin with, though, I'd like to clarify one point. My friend and colleague, Mr. Vandenberg, who will speak after me, was asked to offer his remarks this afternoon from, quote, unquote, a European perspective. I think that's fine, but that you should not conclude from this that I'm here to present the American perspective. Besides, I was born in Europe. So in the context of NATO, the only perspective that truly matters is the Euro-Atlantic one. The group of experts was, by design, a diverse group, and we really did have some very spirited discussions. But the fundamental question that we considered on each and every issue was not what might be most convenient for any one part of the alliance, but rather what is best for the alliance as a whole. Our analysis and recommendations reflect this, and most of them flow from two basic conclusions. First, the alliance has an ongoing duty to guarantee the safety and security of its members. Second, it can achieve that objective only if it engages dynamically with countries and organizations that are outside its boundaries. To safeguard security at home, the alliance must continue to treat collective defense as its core purpose. And this reflects the primacy of Article 5 and our firm conviction that the security of each ally cannot be separated from that of all. NATO must maintain a flexible mix of military capabilities, including conventional, nuclear, and missile defense. It must also conduct appropriate contingency planning and military exercises so that allies may feel confident that their borders will indeed be protected. And these measures are fundamental to NATO's identity and purpose, but they are not sufficient. Between now and 2020, the alliance will face a new generation of dangers from sources that are geographically and technologically diverse. These threats include violent extremism, nuclear proliferation, cyber assaults, and attacks on energy infrastructure and supply lines. Because such perils can arise rapidly and from any direction, the alliance must become versatile. To this end, NATO should accelerate its military transformation, improve its capacity for rapid response, attach a higher priority to cyber defense, increase the efficiency of military expenditure through joint procurement and specialization. Now, all this is vital, for NATO must be strong, but it also must be smart, and in our era, nothing is smarter than having capable partners. The group of experts was united in our view that partners should play an increasing role in NATO activities and that the alliance should explore every opportunity for strengthening its partnership ties both as a pragmatic means for solving problems and as an instrument of political dialogue. Accordingly, NATO should improve its ability to work with other countries and organizations, especially in situations where a blend of military, economic, and political measures are required. Of course, the European Union, with its overlapping membership, is a NATO partner of singular importance. The experts are eager to see the alliance and the EU operate in a more fully complementary manner based on the principles of reciprocity and cost-effectiveness. We encourage leaders in both organizations to agree on joint participation in meetings, fuller communication between military staffs, and more extensive coordination with respect to preventing and managing crises. A second partnership that attracted discussion within our group is that between NATO and Russia. For reasons of history and geography, some allies are more skeptical than others about Russia's commitment to a positive relationship. This divergence was reflected among the experts, but there was no disagreement about what NATO's policy should be. It's clearly in NATO's best interest to work with Moscow to respond to such shared concerns as terrorism, nuclear proliferation, piracy, and drug trafficking. Partnership, as we know, is a two-way street, but from the alliance perspective, the door to cooperation with Moscow should remain open at all levels. NATO can also influence its security environment by continuing its policy of gradual enlargement. Prospective NATO members in the Western Balkans and elsewhere in the Euro-Atlantic region have a right to fair consideration based on the same guidelines that steered decisions about new members in the past. NATO today is busier than ever, but this does not mean that the alliance must go everywhere and do everything. There are limits to its resources and to its responsibilities. Indeed, the new strategic concept should propose criteria for making wise decisions about when and where to commit NATO resources beyond its boundaries. Now, NATO is more than just a military alliance. It's also a political community and therefore should make more regular and creative use of the mechanism for consultations under Article 4. NATO faces a continuum of threats, and informed discussion can enable it to identify and act on timely options. Alliance leaders should also benefit from lessons learned in Afghanistan, including the imperative of political cohesion, the desirability of unified command, the value of effective planning, the importance of public communications, and the need to deploy forces at a strategic distance for an extended period of time. All these steps must be accompanied by a commitment to organizational reform. The Secretary General should have the authority and the mandate to streamline decision-making, prune the bureaucracy, and identify savings that can be used for military transformation. In the past 8 months, the group of experts had to think deeply about issues that some fear could undermine the future cohesion of the alliance, and these include the apparent tension between homeland defense and expeditionary missions, the difference in attitudes towards Russia, the imbalance in military expenditures, and the nuclear question. When we started out, I confessed to harboring doubts about whether we would be able to define a common approach toward these and the other issues. And in the end, I found that the desire for agreement far outweighed the dubious pleasures of argument, and that more importantly, the basis for a common approach was not that difficult to find. No one can expect an alliance of 28 members to function without occasional grumbling and dissent. But I arrive at the end of this stage in the process with more optimism about NATO's continued unity and future success than when I began, and I hope that others feel the same. And I really do look forward to having a very open discussion with the next generation, though I see some people that are slightly older in the audience. Thank you all very, very much.
Thank you very much for your kind introductions, ladies and gentlemen. Rather than to give you more information, let me just emphasize one point. In the end, NATO can only be successful if there is sufficient public support in the countries who are a member. And the fact is, based on Pew Center data, that whilst NATO support is still very high, it is slowly going down. In most European countries, the support, if you ask the question, do you think is NATO a good organization? You have all kind of check questions. But then you see the answers will be between 60 and 80% that people think NATO is a good organization. That's quite high, by the way, from if you compare it to other international organizations. Having said that, it goes slowly down. Not such a surprise, because if you had an enemy that doesn't longer exist in the Cold War, it is much easier to explain what NATO is all about. By the way, if I look at the States, you have the same phenomenon, but they start even a bit lower. So how does, if you think about public support, how can we do something in our advice to help to stop that public support goes down, or preferably even to improve it? Now, we gave it a lot of thought, and I gave it a lot of thought myself, and then you come, at least my insight, how to gain public support on this subject, you have to pass three green lights. The first one is, for public support, you need to have a good track record. Now, probably you know here what NATO has done. I give it a full green light. The second one is, you must have a clear strategy going forward. And that strategy should be explainable. We used in the Atlantic Council terms from, it should be possible to explain it to the milkman. Today it was to the chef of the cuisine, but whatever you see the point I try to make. There should be quite easy, in a kind of elevator speech, this is what NATO likes to do, and this is what NATO not is doing. So the lines that we used this morning, NATO is, you can sometimes better explain it by what it is not. NATO is not a global policeman, or NATO is a regional organization that can act globally. Or NATO will not deal with all threats, but which threats you deal. So that is giving clarity over the purpose and role of NATO, or giving clarity about its strategy, and that happens to be the strategic concept. Now, that is, of course, our advice tries to help with that. That was the second green light. Now, what is the third green light? Is that in the end, if you have a clear strategy and a track record, you still like to understand, which people are leading that organization? Do I trust that people? And that's why I very much appreciate how Madam Secretary led a very transparent process to make our advice. That's why I very much appreciate the open style of the new Secretary General and the way he gives his speeches and takes questions, and how I think it will go leading to the new strategic concept in Lisbon in November, because by transparency, I think you instill that trust. Now, and if we achieve that, then we have the third green light, and then I would be delighted if indeed in some years' time we see that public support is moving the other way. This is the end of my introduction. Yep.
Thank you very much for that. You've spent the last couple of months in a sort of listening mode, the last couple of weeks in a writing mode, and hopefully in the next couple of weeks a talking and speaking mode, because I understand you'll be traveling around NATO to explain what it is that you've come up with, shortly leaving for the United States to address Congress. So my question reading your report is a sort of, to start off, you lay out what the main challenges are, and I noticed you talk about ballistic missile defense or the threat of an attack, you talk about cyber attack, and you talk about terrorism. These are very much the sort of the things that NATO allies need to worry about, but they're also the kind of things that NATO is only partially involved in. So how to make the elevator speech convincing when the major threats that you outline aren't really the major tasks that NATO currently contemplates?
Well, first of all, I think that What we are trying to do is take an alliance that is 61 years old, that started under a very different concept, and modernize it to deal with those threats. And I do think that one of the aspects that we pointed out is that while we can't pinpoint each one of the threats, we know that NATO has to be agile and flexible to deal in an environment that's very unpredictable. One of our hard points, I think, is to try to persuade people that the threats that we outline, whether they're terrorism or proliferation or cyber, are really threats to them, because people have different views of what threatens their daily life. When you heard daily about the fact that Soviet troops were massed on borders or tanks were coming over the Folder Gap, that was much more visible. The way that we're dealing with your specific question is through the fact that I think perhaps the most innovative thing we talked about in this report is the need for partnerships. What we learned is that there are... This doesn't work. I thought they heard me. No? Okay. I won't start over. there are more partners than there are allies, that a number of these issues that don't come from inside or are not just at the borders of NATO are somewhere out in the further away, that you do require partners for that. And I think that that works in terms of including more countries and more people that have a vested interest in this working, but also does explain that there are shared responsibilities and that we are all responsible for each other. But it is harder to explain it. We were talking earlier about the fact that not everybody in Europe feels the same threats from terrorism that the United States does. And so I think we need to have more explanations of the commonality of the threat and the fact that there are partners out there that can, in fact, help.
Can I push you? Can everybody hear me? Right, great. Can I push you a little on this? Because I think the report does a great service by taking the next step in consideration of threats and says it isn't just a question of conventional threats. Political pressure is a real concern for some allies. Cyber attack is a real concern. And I think there's a sentence saying that NATO should help defend allies and their political independence. But how does NATO do that? Is that where the consultations that you addressed in your speech come in? Is that what that's for? How does NATO do that?
Well, first of all, NATO is an alliance of democracies. I think that is a very basic aspect of it. And democracies not only want to see their own democracies safe and secure, but like to see other countries where people are able to make their own choices and there is a sense of stability. I think, put more of an emphasis on Article 4 than had been done before, which was the fact that NATO is a political community where, in fact, there can be consultations among the ambassadors at the NATO Council, and that the better part of valor is try to prevent problems, and if, in fact, there are discussions and consultations, that political stability can be maintained by sharing evaluations of problems and thinking about what other methods there are to preserve that political independence and stability short of using military force.
I would like to press you on a key element that Mr. Van der Veer mentioned in his speech. So this is a question for both of you about this paradox where we indeed see a real crisis in the European resolve to engage in tackling threats, to commit troops abroad, like Afghanistan. But yet Europeans still, as a majority, feel confident about NATO. And yet we see the very opposite picture in the United States, where there is a resolve to act, there is a resolve to go and take risks, but yet there is also a real public opinion crisis on NATO, which you mentioned when you were in Washington during the Group of Experts tour. So I would like to know how we can square this circle of the lack of European resolve, but a growing public opinion crisis in the United States where people don't see what NATO's purpose is about.
Well, let me just state that, as Mr. Vanderveer mentioned, and data has shown, support for NATO is actually lowest in the United States, which I find very depressing, frankly. But part of it has to do with the fact that there is a discrepancy between the amount that the United States provides for NATO in terms of military support and budget and what some of the other allies do. There has been a little bit of a sense of free rider. And there is a sense that, in fact, it would be nice if the contributions were larger from NATO members. I can, to myself, explain some of this by saying that, in fact, I wish that there had been a different approach to Afghanistan early on. NATO activated Article 5, but the whole concept of how NATO would respond to Afghanistan was not fully carried out until recently. And so there's a little bit of a sense of, what do we need a bunch of allies that don't do what they're supposed to do? But I think that if people understand that there is strength in an alliance of united democracies on behalf of the kinds of problems we were talking about, that it is definitely worth it. But we are going to have to go around and explain that. I think there is no question about that. And that will be part of the discussion that goes on. I happen to believe that the United States is much stronger with partners. I also happen to believe that the alliance, the relationship between U.S. and Europe, is the key alliance in terms of value systems and how we operate in the 21st century. But I think the onus is going to be on us to explain what this is all about.
Can you hear me in the back? First, the fact is more than 40 countries are involved in Afghanistan, and all NATO members are involved. Maybe not that they share the equal size of the burden, but overall it is still quite impressive. The second, if you try to think, if you advise about a strategic concept, in fact, whilst many people are busy with Afghanistan today, in fact you advise about a strategy after Afghanistan, or beyond Afghanistan, NATO 2020. And if I take your question there, then I think there are two important things. One, the first important remark is that we set out in our report, I think, 8 guidelines, that if you ever would consider a new mission out of area, what are the guidelines? And in fact, you should tick off all 8 of them. And then it should be a threat against most members. It should be political will. You should have thought through what kind of how to work with civilian organizations. There should be budgets over time. It should be decision making, how it is arranged with international law, all those kind of things. Now, that is the international guidelines, which I think improves the quality of decision making. We hope, if, let's not hope so, ever consider another out of area mission to be needed. The second one is, and I see that more in Europe, of course, than I see that in the States. If you join an out-of-area mission, then it may be for certain politicians, they say, well, you have to do that in Europe because you are with the Americans in an alliance. I think that's a very bad argument of a politician. In my view, a local politician should explain why is it in the interest of his member or her member country to be involved in something like that. And that is absolutely essential for the future. Otherwise, you will never form a strong alliance and you get the problems you try to indicate.
Well, I wonder if we can continue a bit on the European-NATO dimension before we perhaps return to Afghanistan. There was a great hope some time ago that the Lisbon Treaty would relax a lot of Europeans, would make them more comfortable in their own institutional skin, and therefore allow for much greater cooperation between NATO and the EU, particularly in places where both organizations are deployed, like Afghanistan. But it strikes me that despite the Lisbon Treaty, we haven't quite reached that stage. There still are institutional rivalries, political problems, and of course, a much bigger problem for the Europeans now to concern themselves with in the broader economic crisis. Now, you call on leaders in both organizations to collaborate, but I wonder what the sort of roadmap to that kind of collaboration is, because we've called on leaders to collaborate on this for some time now, and we haven't really seen the kind of progress that everybody would like.
Well, first of all, it was very interesting because we did, in fact, have a consultation with EU representatives and felt that it was very important to have that. I have to admit it was at a time when the EU was feeling more robust. And there was kind of a sense that this was the organization that had the upper hand. But what we believed, and we stated, first of all, that the taxpayers for NATO and EU are the same people. And it behooves the political figures in both places to make clear to people that they're getting their money's worth. We did lay out some very specific suggestions in terms of more mill-mill consultations, of having greater interoperability, of sharing intelligence, and a variety of ways of hooking the organizations together. And I think that, rationally, that makes a lot of sense. The problems that are out there now, and we've been talking about this a little bit in the last 48 hours, is basically that the financial issues are deep cutting and are the kind that affect ordinary, you know, normal, ordinary people. And that, in fact, it makes it in some ways harder to argue, but in other ways easier, because it shows that duplication and kind of family rivalry is a luxury that cannot be afforded at this point. And so I do think that we hope that some of the roadmap will be followed out in terms of very detailed, not negotiations, but consultations between the two organizations. The thing that I really am very pleased that we came up with in the report is not a sense that NATO is the be-all and end-all and can do everything by itself, but in fact a sense of the necessity for partnering with a variety of organizations, and obviously the EU comes first to mind. The other thing that happened that was very interesting, in our first seminar, we laid out all the problems that were out there in the world, and you kind of had the feeling that NATO should deal with all of them, and then somebody had a really fabulous image and said, NATO cannot be like a Swiss Army knife that has all the things extended, because it means you can't even pick it up. So you have to figure out what is the appropriate job for NATO, what is the appropriate job for the EU, for the UN, for OSCE, for Russia, or whatever. And that, I think, is where we came up with something quite novel about the fact of that NATO is not alone, and NATO is not the world's policeman, and that these partnerships are very important and a way of being a force multiplier.
To be a bit provocative, the thing that everybody seems to be saying they want to focus on is crisis management. So you say it in your report, the EU says it in some of its documents, and Vice President Joe Biden said it in the Herald Tribune that it should be about the OSCE. So crisis management is what everybody seems to gravitate towards. And so my concern is, well, how do we divide the task? Is it geographical? Is it just more liaison between these organizations? So it's a detailed question, but I hear what you say when you say NATO shouldn't do everything, but it strikes me that these three organizations still end up gravitating towards doing that same thing, broadly described as crisis management.
Eddie?
He's somebody that knows... oil crisis management.
We'll come back to that.
I need you in the Gulf of Mexico.
The interesting one is when I started this work and I thought about, for instance, about Europe, EU, Brussels, and NATO, I thought it's my experience from private business sector. This is easy. Because basically if there is rivalry, that means there are overlaps. So then you have to define that the role and purpose on both sides of the rivalry, that there is clarity, and then you can manage the overlaps away. So then I thought, okay, why is that so easy? Because NATO is hard power and EU is soft power. Yeah? And then you work on that, and then you manage it away, and they go happy together. I can tell you it is not that easy. Because NATO, there's a lot of hard power in NATO, but you can't, EU without any hard power doesn't work. I can explain that, it's probably not a fully logical thought. So my next best idea, not personal idea, after thanks all the discussions we had in the expert group, and it is in a very, you can see it in the report, is basically you have to address it, and the Madeleine made that point, top down, that's one. Because otherwise you can't have a static solution. You can't say this is for the coming 10 years EU, and that is for the coming 10 years NATO, and there will be no overlaps. So it is much better that you have a periodic review, top-down, where hopefully, that is then important, the chemistry between the top two persons work. And they drive it then down. And if you see that there is no split all the time to tackle the overlaps or the productivity of the two organizations or the interoperability, then you may be amazed how quickly it can go. But that's how you, basically, how that's my advice how to tackle that.
Lead from the top.
Let's carry on the notion of partner and talk about the looming partner, Russia. Because you spend quite a bit of time in the report talking about how to follow on this reset of U.S.-Russia relationship. But is there a game changer in the way NATO and Russia should work together? Is membership something conceivable that should be on the table? Or is it just about managing Russia and managing a relationship that is made of good and less good?
Well, first of all, let me say I am very pleased in the way that we handled the Russia issue in the report, I thought quite elegantly, by in fact saying that there had been some differences among the experts in terms of how they regarded Russia, some for geographical and historical reasons. But no matter what those differences were, there was unanimity in saying that there had to be a different relationship with Russia and one in which there was active engagement. And so I think there has to be a recognition that not everybody thinks exactly the same. Where I believe that this should go is that the game changer, in some ways, the NATO-Russia Council fell into disuse. It has been revived, but also I think there are more and more discussions about what more can be done in the NATO-Russia Council, what subjects can be discussed there, what is the mechanism for agreement. Are there some issues that don't have to be 28 plus 1? Are there ways that there are various discussions that can happen? The other, I think, has to do with the fact that if you write down what are the new threats, some of them affect the Russians as much as they affect other people. What we found interesting, for instance, it may seem like the least important out of the list if you start with nuclear proliferation, but drug trafficking is something that undermines the stability of a country and is something that the Russians raised. Terrorism, there may be somewhat different definitions of who's a terrorist, but I think that it is important to think about how work can be done together, certainly on nuclear proliferation. There is no question. And the signing of the START Treaty is a point, in fact, and a number of ways. So I think that what we advocated was a very transactional way of dealing with problems that we have in common with the Russians to work on them together, evolving a sense of confidence and a different narrative, frankly. The Russians were totally convinced that what we were doing in the 90s was against them, when it's simply not true. That was not the issue. And so I think it's important to have a narrative now that does show a willingness to have an open hand and an open door. We can't change the guidelines for membership. And Article 10 leaves possibility of becoming a member of NATO if, in fact, you abide by the criteria that other countries have had there. Being a democracy is one of them. And I think that the very important point here is to try to figure out what are the avenues of working together.
But how would that concretely apply? Let's take an example in regional security, because I think we're talking about those transversal threats like drugs, terrorism, but we also have some real on-the-ground crises in Georgia, in various other parts of the Caucasus. So how will this new kind of relationship apply within the next 10 years?
Well, I think it'll have to be on a case-by-case basis. One of the issues that we didn't shy away from talking about Georgia, we said that the events in Georgia had, in fact, complicated the way that the NATO-Russia Council had worked, or that, in fact, consultations had not worked. And so I think that part of the way it would apply, for starters, would that there would be discussion and consultations about X issue in the Caucasus, for instance, but I think we would take it of building trust one step at a time. I think the important point is to actually do things rather than make grandiose statements about the fact that we are now loving partners. And so I think that the issue here is how to take one step at a time, test the extent to which they want to be partners, and move forward with the idea, as I said, that everybody in the expert group felt that it was important to engage. And one of the issues that's come up is missile defense. And one way, perhaps, of beginning to bridge the gaps and develop issues is over very practical aspects of how the missile defense system would work.
Now, I was just saying, giving the same example, missile defense, realized that a year ago we were still talking about missile, anti-missile defense in East European states, and now we say explicit in this report how we should cooperate with the Russians. So I think this is not a gray advice. This is very clear what we mean, how to re-engage.
But do we need to send benchmarks for ourselves vis-a-vis the Russians of what we expect from them? Because often what we hear is that there's a requirement for a reset, but what do we judge that reset against? Should NATO internally develop a checklist of sorts of what it would like to see that it can measure Russian NATO partnership by?
Well, I think let me just make one thing clear back again, is we did not write the strategic concept. What we have done is provide the building blocks for the Secretary General, who then has to do a lot of additional consulting and then take the whole thing to the heads of state. So I don't want to prejudge that. I, speaking for myself personally, I think that it would be useful to kind of at least mentally have something that would show the level of cooperation, because it takes two to or 29 or whatever number to really do this. But what is interesting to me is that when we went to Russia, there is not a monolithic approach to this. I mean, meeting with academicians and students in Russia, there were a variety of different opinions, and there may be different messages from some of the leaders. The bottom line is that there is a thinking process going on there in terms of what they want, how they see their threats, and I think it's a matter of a step-by-step process. In my own head, as somebody that used to do this for a living, I mean, you do try to have a set of benchmarks in your head. Sometimes, however, it's valuable to have them public, and sometimes it's better not to. And that's what the decision makers have to figure out.
I wonder whether we can switch the ground onto these new threats, because in the report, you talk a bit about NATO's role in protecting global lifelines, the alliance's lifelines. And of course, this is an area that you know a lot about from your previous professional experience. The question I have is, what is the extent of NATO's role in this lifeline protecting business? You know, is it appropriate in future for NATO to start thinking about its role vis-a-vis gas pipelines? Is it appropriate for NATO to start thinking not just about piracy off the Horn of Africa, but safe passage in the Indian Ocean? How did you come down on where you think NATO ought to focus when it comes to some of these lifeline questions?
Yeah, when we started our work, we made a kind of quickly a list from what at least some people thought not necessarily experts, but people that we take input, what kind of new threats NATO then should deal with, at least according their opinion. Now, you had, of course, the new threats, terrorism, after 9/11, the old strategic concept was 1999, you had piracy or marine security, you had the cyber attack, you had the energy supplies, climate change, the high Arctic. Now, I must have forgotten some. And then we started to discuss that. By the way, there were sitting some other experts and some people helped us as well. And then let me take as example energy security. I thought a bit in my past about that. And then if you say, okay, what is it then? Energy security, what has NATO to do? We said, not seriously, a soldier on every kilometer of pipeline. Yeah, that doesn't help. Or near every valve on the pipeline. Now, that's not. And then if you think it through, then you see that energy security means that basically a country has organized the energy supplies. And why is that? Because you have to import it. Because if you have your own stuff, yeah, you have automatic security. It's not an issue. If you have to import it, now then if you make your country yourself dependent on one other country, yeah, you take a risk. So what you learn about energy security is you have to invest. Secure means that you have alternatives if something happens. And that's a kind of economic optimization. Yeah, so you can go from one gas supply to another gas supply, or you can, if you can't make your electricity based on gas, natural gas, you can make electricity based on oil or nuclear or what have you. So I don't think that NATO is there to be, because you are underinvested, which is basically good common sense, and domestic policies. Now, you see that on one of the last pages in our report, we spelled it out. Now, if you take this now to a wider message, what we say, and Secretary Albright said it very careful, NATO is not a jack of all threats, or everything to all persons, or the Swiss knife. So you must have a logic. First of all, is there a threat? Yes. Is it applicable to many alliance members? If you say yes, fine. Are there other organizations taken care of? Yes, fine. Nothing for NATO. If other organizations don't do a good job, can our diplomats solve something? And they should try very hard. Now, then if you pass all those decision criteria, then you may end up with a threat, which is indeed a threat against most members. Other organizations can't do it, the politicians can't solve it, and so on. Then is, can NATO do something? And is there support? And can it, to an international law? And that's how you should approach it. And you see in our report that while some people thought a year ago that we do something about energy security, now you read it for yourself, pretty marginal, climate change, basically we say, yeah, in theory, something may come out, which is a security aspect that people start to move because the climate has changed, but basically we say for the time being. Now, I can go through all those threats, but we did something very important as well. And let me explain that. We think if you make a strategy or a strategic concept for the coming 10 years, then I don't know what happens in the year 2017 and the year 2018. And maybe that is quite different what we expect now. So you have to build decision-making mechanisms. That is what Secretary Albright called this agility, to deal with unknown situations. Yeah? And that's, of course, very important. And that's why we think you should use Article 4 for that. And maybe you can then solve it in the context of Article 4, the consultation paragraph, or maybe there is one day that you have to refer to Article 5. But by doing that way, and then the language is not in the report, but the verbal language we used is, then you keep Article 5 pure. And I think that is better for the clarity of your strategy.
Right. I think we've come to the section in the program where we're going to turn to you for the interesting and challenging questions. We've got half an hour. We've got some roving mics. So do raise your hand if you'd like to ask the panel a question or two. And please do introduce yourself and tell us where you're from. But perhaps we can encourage the next generation to have a first go. Go on. You're not the next generation, Richard Wright. Come on, some of the young people.
Okay, they are shy.
All right, gentleman over there in the corner with you.
I'm not from the University of Kent, not from the College of Europe, but the University of Antwerp. I have two questions on arms control and what you called the mix of conventional nuclear and missile defense. My first is about the nuclear weapons. Why not fully recommending the withdrawal of the remaining tactical nuclear weapons in Europe? The military, they say that they are military useless. Politically, their presence sends the wrong signal to potential proliferators. And in Germany, even the government, in Belgium, the Netherlands, in Italy, and probably even in Turkey, the vast majority would like to see them out. In short, why waiting on this? I think NATO's legitimacy is decreasing in these countries because of this status quo and inertia. And then a second critical question is about missile defense. It's a new buzzword, a new mission even. Are you aware that the current and the foreseeable missile defense technology simply does not work? And I'm not talking only about the strategic interceptors, but also the SM-3 missiles, interceptors, on Aegis ships because of the countermeasures and decoys, as was recently written in an article by George Lewis from Cornell University and Ted Postel from MIT in Arms Control Today. So that has also to do with credibility and legitimacy.
Thank you. Nobody should say that the next generation isn't very well informed. But we had Kent University. Now, can we have somebody from the other university, just so the competition continues? Nobody yet. Okay. One more question, and then we'll return to the panel. Yes, you, sir, here in the front.
Thank you to our guest lecturers. My name is Ahmed Jalani, and I'm from the University of Sussex, so it's separate from the rest of the universities. My question is regarding Russia, NATO. Given the fact that there exists a long-standing trust deficit between Russia and the West, do you still think that there's a possibility of a strong NATO-Russia cooperation? And secondly, what is the West doing to reduce that trust deficit? Thank you.
Thank you. So, four questions. Why didn't you recommend the immediate removal of the tactical nuclear weapons? Is missile defense really realistic? And how do we actually work to address the trust deficit? Yeah.
Well, let me start with the nuclear. Let me say that it's actually President Obama that has talked about the moving ultimately to a nuclear-free world. And he has taken a number of very interesting steps in that regard, not only speeches, but moving forward on the NATO, on the START Treaty, on having a summit, being very active in the review of the Non-Proliferation Treaty generally. But until that moment, NATO is basically has been an alliance that has really, in many ways, been dependent on a nuclear deterrent. And our sense was that until we reach that time, and so long as Russia continues to have a very large number of tactical nuclear weapons on its territory, that the following things made sense. One is that there should be whatever decisions were made about tactical nuclear weapons on the territory of NATO countries, it should be as the result of an alliance decision. We made a number of references to the necessities for alliance decisions, that this is an alliance where there is consensus and it operates on that basis. The other point that we made was that whatever decisions are made should be done on a reciprocal or mutual basis in some way that reflected the current situation in terms of Russia-NATO, but that it should not be a unilateral approach, nor should in terms of the alliance just making a unilateral decision, that it needed to be an alliance decision and there needed to be mutuality involved in it.
The missile defense, you said it doesn't work. I don't know, but I have to say we have had a lot of talks to the military, and that has certainly increased my confidence in their competences. But it is an obvious point. If it doesn't work, you need good engineers, so don't build it. Yeah?
the strong NATO-Russian cooperation on the trust deficit. I have gone through an experience in my capacity as chief executive of Shell with the Russians, where we had a very large project on Sakhalin Island, and we were not real friends, so to say. That may be for those who had followed that in the press. In the end of the day, the plant operates now very well. The Russians are very proud of it. And what is my point? That if you work together on specific projects, that is what really instills trust. So whilst it is a good idea in itself to invite the Russians for a common missile defense cooperation, the more projects where you can really actually operate, I think that drives and that closes the bridge of the trust deficit. So, and I hope that, and then especially if the NATO-Russian Council, as Secretary Albright said, which is then basically the steering mechanism, and you don't have a big disturbance like Georgia was, then I think we can make a lot of progress.
Thank you. Let's open up again for some questions. Yes.
My name is Reinhard Bütikofer. I'm an MEP and, so to speak, representing the baby boomers here. I have two questions. One, at the Munich Security Conference, Secretary General of NATO described one of its future roles as being the global hub of a network of security organizations. That description hasn't figured at all in what you presented. So I would be interested in how you see that. And the second question, to what degree do you believe the next NATO strategy should be discussed with new global powers?
Thank you for that. From the European Parliament to the European Commission, Richard, I'm coming back to you.
There's Paula Damson at the back. Paula.
Sorry, Richard Wright from the European Commission. I was very happy to have been consulted by Secretary Albright and Mr. van der Veer in the preparation of the report. And let me say, I think it's an excellent, well-written document. My question is on an aspect that hasn't been touched on so far, which is your rather strong endorsement of comprehensive approaches to crisis management, the non-hierarchical, let's say, ranking of military means, political means, civilian means, etc. And in particular to a passage towards the end of the document where you're rather critical of NATO's relations with civilian organizations, saying they have to be strengthened, and two of the solutions you put forward are, one, to have a civilian planning unit within NATO, and secondly, to build up to draw up a roster of experts, sort of crisis management experts, who could be deployed even in certain circumstances. And this is quite far-reaching. I mean, I'm wondering, is there not an incompatibility or potential incompatibility between, on the one hand, wanting to strengthen your relations with civilian organizations, which would be EU, UN, and others, and at the same time building up some sort of capability yourself, which could, certain circumstances, overlap or even, in worse circumstances, conflict with perhaps the goals of the civilian organization with whom you want to strengthen relations.
And let's do one more question in this round. Yeah, lady right there.
Stefanie Bolzen, German Daily Die Welt. I have a question to Dr. Albright. You are very clear and outspoken about missile defense shield, missile defense as a mission for within the strategy. So the US government is very much pressuring on this issue and want a decision by the Lisbon summit. What is your assessment? Do you think this is possible by November? And if not, what will the US government do?
Let's come back. So Reinhard asked about what happened to the Secretary General's concept of NATO as a hub and whether or not the future strategic concept ought to be discussed with the emerging powers, by which I mean you mean Brazil, India, and so on, perhaps. And Richard talked about whether some of the capabilities you call for, comprehensive capabilities, will preclude the kind of good-natured cooperation with the EU that you also want. So perhaps start with you.
Well, let me say that this truly has been one of the most transparent and consultative processes that NATO has been involved in. And we talked to a lot of different people in different countries, and the idea of the hub kind of didn't work, frankly, in terms of the fact that NATO would look like a global organization when it is not designed to be a global organization. We, however, did think that it was useful for NATO to develop these much larger numbers of partners and partnerships, either with organizations or with individual countries. And so there is this sense that NATO has the capability of reaching out when, in fact, it needs help in a particular area, or vice versa, when a partner organization feels that it needs help. I did the consultation with the United Nations, and there was kind of a sense, well, there is a global organization. How do they operate together, and what is the consultative mechanism? But it is, and also to your point about reaching out to other partners, this is supposed to be a an organic aspect of just kind of seeing where help and how we can all help each other in dealing with these various threats. It, in some ways, laps over into the next question about where we came out with this was that NATO, in fact, and it came again from the seminars in terms of learning about how the comprehensive approach worked. And there was very much a determination that NATO itself needed a better way to plug in to the civilian capabilities of other organizations. As somebody, again, who's been through this, it takes a while to get the other organizations organized and motivated. And so in the interim, for two reasons, one, to have a civilian component within NATO that can relate to some of the civilian components in other organizations, and also to fill a time gap, it does not hurt. And we did not think of it as competitive at all, but more of a complementary way that the comprehensive approach could work if NATO had a section within the Secretariat or within the organization that was able to relate to the civilian organizations.
Now, there was a question about, I'm not sure I understood it right, the missile defense system by November. Was that your question?
I think Stephanie asked whether it was feasible to reach a cross-allied agreement by the Portugal, the Lisbon summit on missile defense.
Now, I realize that in the press conference, the Secretary General has already said that he really liked this initiative, this statement that the missile defense system, that NATO should be very active there, and that at least from a personal point of view, he supported that, of course. And then he said, of course, we have to get all the countries behind that. So basically, if I decode that in normal language, that will be very much part of the discussions leading to the Lisbon Agreement.
Yeah. Can I, the missile defense issue, let me just raise it in a number of different ways. First of all, goes to whether it works or not. I think one of the issues that was out there in the previous 8 years was whether the decisions that the United States had made in terms of emplacing various parts of missile defense in particular countries was the right approach to go at it bilaterally. And there really then became a discussion about the fact that this should be a NATO issue, a NATO discussion. Then there also, and this goes a little bit to the Russia question, that the missile defense is against other places and that the threat is coming from a different area, and that, in fact, that was a way that there could be a very legitimate cooperation on how to deal with the issue, both in terms of NATO's decision-making as well as partnerships with Russia. Again, I can't speak for the United States government, but I think that there is a certain amount of momentum behind this, and as Mr. Vanderveer said, and again was reiterated today by the Secretary General, he does see this as something that will have to be, that he approves of, but also has to be taken up by alliance heads of state at the November Lisbon meeting.
Thank you. Let's open up another round of questions. We have about 10 minutes. Yes, why don't we stop there, Paul? Yes, you've got your hand up. Oh, well. You, sir, yeah, and then go back to Paul.
Hi, Henrik Biller from the NATO Parliamentary Assistant, Research Assistant. You're both talking a lot about taking specific steps towards the Russians and tackling the small issues and step by step. But how do you tackle the fact that the Russians are almost saying the opposite, that they want to broaden the issues? Medvedev is talking about the European security architecture and the nuclear weapons, the tactical nuclear weapons, that on the other hand also implies the conventional forces in Europe treaty. How do you tackle this?
And there, yeah.
Thank you. My name is Paul Adamson, publisher of eSharp magazine. I used to be the next generation, but many decades ago. nobody disputes that it's a dangerous world we're living in and that they're growing by the day, it seems to me. But I'm trying to understand why, against the backdrop of, as you say, Madam Albright, this lowering of public support for NATO or even understanding of NATO and the economic recession and the free ride aspect you were talking about, why there's not more support for this new turning point for NATO. And it seems to me the problem is maybe the issue for this report and maybe for the internal discussions for NATO, but it's based on my very cursory reading of this report, is that what you're doing basically, you're talking about in terms of structures, in terms of new services, in terms of new functions, a further enlargement of NATO, just like membership enlargement over the past 10 years, when people are saying, well, we haven't got the resources, we haven't got the money to support that, where people free riding, and maybe, again, I may be misreading your report and maybe some of the little insights I have of NATO discussions, is that you're, in effect, trying to bolt on all these very important new services, new structures, new functions onto an existing structure, which to many people, frankly, is seen as dysfunctional. And maybe what's missing is more effort being spent on saying, well, before we start, well, we will do all these new things. It's impossible to find fault with your recommendations, clearly they're so obviously self-evidently worthy of support. However, if they're not done in the context of also of NATO itself being restructured and revisited and reviewed, given that people are saying it's there's too many committees, there's too much talking, the structures are dysfunctional, then you're not going to have the full success of your recommendations going forward.
Let's add one more question. Right there, gentlemen. Right there.
Hi, my name is Andre Kern from the College of Europe. My question relates to the responsibility to protect. And one of the points in the report discusses the role of the NATO Response Force. And I'm looking, my question is with regards also to the development of the EU battle groups, whether there was any discussion on R2P during your work and whether you see NATO's role in the concept. Thank you.
Great. So the first question was, my mother used to say, how do you eat an elephant, you know, bite by bite? The first question seemed to be saying, we want to eat the elephant bite by bite, but the Russians want to sort of eat the entire elephant. How do we deal with that tension? And then the second question I'm going to interpret as a, you know, where's the call for root and branch reform of NATO? You know, isn't this just a bit sort of fixing the old car here and there rather than a big call for reform? And then finally, a question on R2P.
Well, let me say the first and second question kind of go together a little bit. I think that one can always decide, disband the organizations that exist and start over. I actually think NATO is a pretty good organization that has shown its worth over its lifetime. It has certain aspects that have to be changed, and we have argued that in terms of reform measures and streamlining and a variety of different ways of acting. But I am willing to still put my money behind what has been the greatest military alliance in the history of the world, and the question is how it does adapt. I think one has to look at the motivations, a little bit of suggestions for new groupings. And this is not simple. The question is whether you, every time you have a problem, you invent some new organization, or whether you try to figure out how to operate with what you have. When I was Secretary of State, I have to tell you that I had times I never could find a European minister because they were always in some meeting. So I asked the Intelligence and Research Department of the State Department to make a chart for me, and it looked a little bit like some kind of astrological or astronomical chart with Bulgaria's Pluto. And I said, you know, this is the Euro mess. And so we cannot, in fact, keep creating new organizations. That is my personal view, and that there is a core aspect of NATO that is that one should feel confident about, and that we have a way of making it work. I think with the Russians, we have. I think the NATO-Russia Council actually has great possibilities of doing step by step, trying it out, and seeing how it works. And I hope that that will be the way that one does it bite by bite. And I think there's great value in that. And to pick up, in fact, where Mr. Van der Veer said, is that if you're working on issues, you may find cooperation. Let me just say the other thing is, this has a little bit to do with R2P. It is very interesting that when you are a decision maker and something terrible happens somewhere, and you want to do something about it, you look inside your toolbox and you try to figure out which organization will do the job. You need to, there is some necessity for rapid action, especially in a question of R2P or a question in terms of where people are dying. And you think, okay, and I can tell you, and some, there may be people in this room who are critical of this, but when people were being ethnically cleansed in Kosovo and the United Nations was not capable of doing the job, NATO was there to do the job. And if NATO hadn't been, we would have found something else that existed that had a capability of acting. R2P is a very complicated issue. It runs into questions of sovereignty. But we have in our report that we do think that there ought to be ways that people need to be protected or helped either after a humanitarian disaster or a disaster caused by humans. And so we have that in there.
Did you want to add anything?
No, the fixing the old car is that, first of all, the strategic concept in 1999, these were intelligent people who tried to look forward. And their advice, of course, if you take it at the time, I think was a good strategic concept. But the world has changed, so you have to adapt. And one day people will say, yeah, they worked very hard over about this 2010, but it is time to, that's how it is. And I think that it is always a bit easy to say it is an old, I use your jargon, not of the person who asked the question, but is it not a bit fixing up? I think if you really take the report, this is an absolutely not grey report. This report makes many choices, both, we say regional organization, we say those threats, yes, and then a lot of advices, reforms, and all kinds of things. So if you really work it through, we try, of course, to say it very polite, but there are some very clear advices in it. And I think that is real progress, and I hope it, of course, to be a real help to the Secretary General for the Lisbon agreement, which has to be made. About the NATO response force, I think we acknowledge in the report that more progress should have been made. Yeah? And let me stop there. And back to you.
Well, thank you very much. I think that's an excellent point to stop on. A lot of progress has been made, but more needs to be made in future. Please join me in thanking Secretary Albright and Chairman Van der Veer. And let's also thank Carnegie Europe and, of course, European Council on Foreign Relations for making all this possible. So thank you, Fabrice. That's it, folks.